Welcome to Inside the New York Times Book Review. I'm Sam Tannenhaus. This week, a conversation with author Francisco Goldman about his new novel, Say Her Name, a remarkable study in loss and recovery.
For one thing, the book is a gift to myself, because now I know that, say, in how many of years when my memories are faded or senile or whatever, I'll be able to open this book and there will be a version of her that I can reconnect with.
Julie Bosman has notes from the field. Deborah Lipstadt revisits the trial of Adolf Eichmann.
Eichmann was not the chief executive officer of The Final Solution as he was depicted in the courtroom. That they got wrong. But he was one of the pivotal COOs, chief operating officers of The Final Solution.
Pamela Paul, our children's books editor, tells us about a conversation with the great Beverly Cleary. And Jennifer Schuessler has bestseller news. Francisco Goldman is one of the extraordinary writers, novelists of our time, and he's written a most remarkable new book. It's called Say Her Name. It's reviewed on the cover of this week's book review by Robin Rahm, who says Francisco Goldman's book is passionate and moving and a beautifully written account. And I'm going to let Frank Goldman, who's my guest today, tell me what it is an account of. Welcome, Frank.
Hi, Sam. It's a pleasure to be here, an honor.
And it's a very difficult story you're telling, and we should get into this. It's a story of the death of your beautiful young wife, Aura Estrada. And tell us about this.
Well, you know, it's Aura and I, we were together 4 years, married two. I was 22 years older than her at the age of 30, during a very long anticipated summer vacation break in Mexico. We were body surfing, and she had a fatal accident in those waves. Aura was from Mexico City. I met her up here.
In New York.
We started going out together. She was a graduate student in Spanish and Latin American literature at Columbia University, getting her PhD. She struggled with that a bit. One of the main narratives of her life was her dream to become a fiction writer and not be an academic. She was kind of pressured into becoming an academic by sort of familial pressures. She was remarkably talented, brilliant. I used to like to tell people that I basically had two more years left, maybe, of being Francisco Goldman, and that after that I was going to be Mr. Aura Estrada. Anyway, what could be more shattering? You know, she was gone. One day she was there, the next day she was gone. One day, I was a married man looking forward to having a child, which we were going to have in the next year. She was looking forward to her whole life. Her last words, as far as I know, were, "No quiero morir," I don't want to die. I think that says it all. Those first 6 months after her death, they're almost a blank to me now. I know that I was a bit insane. It was just, I try to describe some of it in the book. I began the book 5 months after her death, which might sound kind of soon. I think it was the only thing I had in me that I could do. I've sometimes said, you know, it was that or go under myself. I think that if I had been a mountain climber, you know, to try and keep my life together, I might have said, okay, I'm going to go climb, you know, the highest mountain. But I'm a writer, and my only way of processing things is by writing. And it was Christmas time in Brooklyn, and I just couldn't think of anything worse than being alone in the apartment over the holidays. And a good friend of mine, Chloe Arigis, the young Mexican novelist who writes in English, who was living in Berlin then, she was going home to Mexico to spend the holidays with her parents, and she offered me her apartment in Berlin, a city I'd never been in, but curiously enough that Aura had had some adventures in as a college student. And so I gratefully took it and went to this apartment in this city where I knew almost nobody. It was a perfect match of, I guess, inner mood and setting. I just started to write the book there.
And Frank, let's talk about the complex form you've chosen. You've always been an adventurous and daring writer. Here, you straddle a line so finely between fiction and memoir that even very sophisticated reviewers like our own Robin Rahm and others too aren't quite sure what the result is. They know it's really good, but we weren't even sure what to call this book.
Yeah.
How did you arrive at this form, this approach? There's research and investigation and interviews, but also the most kind of lyrical, personal prose.
When I first started it, I was writing this book exactly how I wanted to write it. I wasn't even necessarily thinking it would be published someday. You know, I turned down an advance, which my editor, Morgan, generously offered just to help me out.
This is your publisher, Morgan Entrick.
Yes, you know, and I just couldn't imagine taking money for this. I think from the start, I conceived of it as a novel. From the very first day, though, and I'll tell you why. That's because I understood this novel was always going to be more about Aura than about me and my grief. I did not want to write a grief memoir. I wanted to write about Aura. On one level, I wanted to capture that part of us that used to communicate through the imagination. You know, she had the most extraordinary imagination. It was one of the things I most loved about her. We shared our writing. She was only two chapters into the novel that she had begun that year at Hunter MFA. And in my mind at the beginning, I thought, you know, the perfect thing for this book will be if our imaginations can communicate somehow. And I always imagined that at the end, my book would sort of merge into her novel. That's what I first thought that first day when I started. And in a sense, you know, and this is the most classical way of writing about death. You know, in so many myths and Greek tragedies and so forth. You know, going into Hades, trying to bring the lover back. And that's most of all what I wanted to do. Was bring her back in words, recreate her as well as I could in words. And so sometimes that meant foregoing the restrictions of fact often. You know, I didn't want anything to get in the way. I wanted all clutter out of there. And so sometimes that meant rearranging things. Sometimes that meant fictionalizing characters. Sometimes that meant altering events. And sometimes that meant imagining things where I wasn't there, you know, in my attempt to sort of get the portraits of her childhood, where often I would only have just a line in the diary or a half-remembered scrap of an anecdote, and I would have to sort of imagine what happened. And as somebody who has written a book of nonfiction where I'm referring to the Art of Political Closer to Murder, where I was under incredible pressure to not get a single fact wrong, you know, everything, every brick had to be in place and solid. I couldn't imagine calling something with that much invention, written with this much freedom, anything but a novel, as autobiographical as it obviously is.
Did you come to know her better in any way after having written this book then?
Oh, yes, completely, right? I mean, I think that's the essence of love, is knowing, you know, with the Zukovsky line, no one who does not know us, does not love us. You know, loving is knowledge of the other person. I went into all her, I mean, it was extraordinary to find her childhood diaries. I always knew they were there, but I'd never really looked through them. You know, in her first one, she had her very first diary there. It had a little blue plastic cover and a little sheep on it from the time she was six. I had all her diaries from the time she was 6 years old. She was a remarkable writer even when she was six. And just to really be able to tell about Aura, to really understand her myself, I had to go back into that past. And so that was a way of getting to know her, you know, that I hadn't in a much richer way. I was aware of, you know, as we all are, like, the, you know, what is the biggest menace that accompanies the loss of a loved one? It's memory. You know, memories fade. You know, they're going to fade in time. And that's why it felt urgent to me to write the book then and there, when her voice was still so fresh in my ear, and the memories were still so fresh. And sometimes that was incredibly painful. You know, it was the opposite of what the shrinks call, you know, moving on or whatever, that everybody, I guess, you know. And but now I'm very glad I did, because as you know, when any time you write a novel, that novel, because you're working on it every day for years, really becomes a part of you. You know, you saturate yourself often with, if it's a fictitious reality or not, And so now I really feel like I can recall out in an instant. I feel that she's really right in me all the time. I can, there's a certain smile I can do, which was her smile, that just brings her back, you know, immediately. For one thing, the book is a gift to myself, because now I know that, say, in how many ever years when my memories are faded or I'm senile or whatever, I'll be able to open this book and, you know, there will be a version of her that I can reconnect with. And also, I'm just so glad I've been able to, through the publication of this book, bring her to readers everywhere. And that's what this review captures so well. The book is more about Aura than it is about me. And when she talks about kind of falling in love with Aura as she reads the book, that makes me feel so great, you know, because that's really what I wanted.
Thanks so much, Frank.
Thank you.
That's Francisco Goldman, whose new book, Say Her Name, is reviewed on the cover of this week's book review. Julie Bosman's here with Notes from the Field. Julie, it's borders again. I hate to say it, but can't they just go away?
Not yet. This week, they presented what they called a restructuring plan to their creditors, which includes some of the biggest publishers in the business, Random House, HarperCollins, Penguin, Perseus, and they did this. It was this very long-awaited meeting. They spent about 5 hours meeting with CFOs and lawyers from the publishers, and they said, here's our plan for getting out of Chapter 11 and becoming a profitable, viable company again.
Wait a minute. They're not going out of business? Is there a term for coming back into business? They're resurrecting themselves?
Well, they filed for Chapter 11 bankruptcy protection in February, which gives them the ability to stay open and keep operating while they figure out where they go next. And what they've done in the last 6 weeks since they've declared bankruptcy is renegotiated a lot of leases with their landlords. They say that they've negotiated about $30 million in rent reductions. And they've whipped up a plan that they hoped would convince publishers that publishers should return to normal trade terms with them. Now, before they declared bankruptcy and before they stopped paying publishers for books, publishers would send them books, and then about 60 days later, Borders would pay them for it, for those books. Now, Borders has been kept on an extremely short leash, and publishers have demanded cash before they ship the books. Now, Borders is very eager to go back to a normal trade arrangement, but publishers are not eager to return to that as well.
So what's the end game here, as far as you can tell?
Well, in the plan this week, you know, Borders really made a very long and very detailed presentation to publishers. They said, we're going to completely revamp our stores. We're going to add more non-book items, nothing revolutionary, but more pens, more stationery, more toys and gifts. They said they want to expand their cafes. They're going to add locally sourced food in where they can do it. They want to add wine. So they presented diagrams to publishers explaining, you know, how the stores are going to look different. Now, one publisher reacted to that by saying, there's a line where a bookstore is no longer a bookstore because there are so many other things in it. So that caused a little bit of distress, but it seems like the main thing that they're counting on is increasing their online sales, and that includes not just ebooks, but sales on their website of print books. They said that by 2015, they hope that 40% of their revenues will come from online sales. Now, publishers said this is a pie-in-the-sky figure. There's absolutely no way this will happen, especially considering that as of last year, top executives at Borders were telling publishers that they believed that ebooks were a blip. So publishers were not convinced by this. And now the next step is that Borders will have to present a formal restructuring plan to the courts. This very long, drawn-out court process will continue, and sometime this summer or as late as the fall, they'll have to decide whether they're going to put themselves for sale or turn to Chapter 7 and liquidate.
Thanks a lot, Julie.
Thanks, Sam.
It's been 50 years since the celebrated trial of Adolf Eichmann, and it's an episode that haunts us still. There's an important new book. It's called The Eichmann Trial by Deborah Lipstadt, an important historian. And it's reviewed for us in the book review by Franklin Foer, who says Lipstadt has done a great service in this book and has recounted the trial vividly. I'm delighted that Deborah Lipstadt is here to talk about it. Welcome.
Thank you, Sam.
All right, 50 years. How does the Eichmann trial look to us now? How significant was it, and how do we think about it today?
Well, it depends who the we is. Some people think about it in terms of Hannah Arendt's presentation, that it was an unfair trial. It was a show trial put on by Israel.
And this is in her famous book.
In her book, famous book, Eichmann in Jerusalem, The Banality of Evil. The more prevalent view is that this trial really helped us put a human face on genocide. My argument is that at the Nuremberg trial, which was the most important war crimes trial prior to the Eichmann trial, you hardly heard from people who had suffered. The prosecutors at Nuremberg were intent on convicting the defendants on the basis of the documents. Documents could not lie. Documents were there in black and white, and they used documents, and a few survivors testified. But the final solution, the persecution of the Jews, was a sidebar at Nuremberg. It wasn't the central item. Comes the Eichmann trial, it's first of all quite a few years, it's 15 years after Nuremberg, the war is over, a new generation is growing up, so that garners more attention for the trial. And of course the way Eichmann is brought to Jerusalem grabs a lot of attention. The Israelis went into Argentina and some would say captured him, but truth be told, they kidnapped him. They kidnapped him, took him out of Arch, put him on an El Al plane, flew him to Israel, and put him on trial.
And there was not universal approval of all this.
Absolutely not. There were many people who were many nations who were very critical of this. They said, first of all, you can't just go in and kidnap someone and take them and put them on trial. B, there was the argument that Israel didn't exist when these crimes were committed, that they weren't committed against Israeli citizens, that this was ex post facto justice. Now, interestingly, Nuremberg was also ex post facto justice. Crimes against humanity didn't exist as a category when these crimes were being committed, number one. Number two, the fact that this wasn't done against Israeli citizens really begs the question, because you had the greatest number of survivors any place in the world in Israel. I don't think the criticisms held up. Some people argued that the trial should be in an international court, but there was no international court.
Deborah, why Eichmann in particular?
Why Eichmann in particular? Eichmann was not the chief executive officer of The Final Solution as he was depicted in the courtroom. That they got wrong. But he was one of the pivotal COOs, chief operating officers of The Final Solution. He was a high school dropout, never finished high school. He had been a traveling salesman, a successful traveling salesman, but nonetheless a traveling salesman, who came into this job. He didn't come in, I don't think he came in tabula rasa in terms of anti-Semitism, but he wasn't a fervent anti-Semite. But he took on the anti-Semitism. He adopted it, he internalized it, he expressed it. And then with a small staff, he scoured parts of Europe, not just to arrange the deportation of the Jews, but to find the Jews, to collect the Jews, to bring them to the death camps, to ensure that the death camps had enough, quote-unquote, room to absorb them, which usually meant that the gas chambers could fully absorb the number of people who were being brought there. He was committed to this cause of finding every single Jew he could find in a way that no one else suppressed him in that way.
So you do deal in the book with Hannah Arendt. Explain why her book was so controversial and what her part is.
Hannah Arendt was a professor at that point at Princeton University. She was the first woman to be a full professor at Princeton. She had published a book, The Origins of Totalitarianism.
Very influential.
Very influential book, study of Nazism and Stalinism in the early 50s. She had been a student in Germany. She got her PhD in Germany. She escaped from Germany shortly after the Nazis came to power, spent most of the 30s in Paris, and then escaped to Paris when they came to the United States.
Was Jewish herself.
She was Jewish. She was from a highly assimilated Jewish family. She presented herself as a long-term German Jew, which she was on her father's side. Actually, on her mother's side, her mother came from Russia and had Eastern European roots, which becomes important later in terms of her comments about the trial. When the trial is announced, when the capture is announced and the trial is announced, she determines that she has to be there. She said, I have to be there because I owe it to myself, having studied totalitarianism, and I owe it to myself on a personal level to see this man in the flesh. So she goes to the New Yorker and she proposes to the New Yorker that she cover the trial. And the New Yorker agrees and sends her to Jerusalem. And she is in the courtroom for much of the trial, but she misses the pivotal moments. She's not there. She's vacationing in Europe. She and her husband meet up with Mary McCarthy, her good friend, the literary critic, the writer. They're in Basel. They're in Switzerland. She's not there when Eichmann is cross-examined. She's not there when Gideon Hausner, the prosecutor, and Adolf Eichmann are going head-to-head. And I think if she had been there, if she had seen him at that moment, she wouldn't have described him as a clown. She wouldn't have described him as someone who was not truly an anti-Semite. She wouldn't have seen him as a paper pusher, which essentially she depicts him as.
What did she miss then?
What did she miss? She missed a number. She missed the degree to which this man was animated by anti-Semitism, had become animated over in the 30s, had adopted anti-Semitism whole hog, so to speak.
As a kind of creed.
As a creed, as a motivating factor in his life. And the degree, the commitment with which he brought to his task. One of the most powerful things that Hausner did, that Gideon Hausner did in the trial.
And he was a prosecutor.
He was the prosecutor. He was the attorney general. Never had been a commercial lawyer, had never tried a criminal case. And this was his moment. One of the things that Hausner does so well during the trial is show how Eichmann was responsible not just for mass deportations, but how if he knew of one Jew in one place, he would go after that Jew. I'll give you an example. At one point, the German Foreign Office is contacted by the Italians, and the Italians say, there is a Jewish woman who is in the ghetto. She's married. She's the wife of an Italian Catholic. Her father-in-law is active in the Italian Fascist Party. We would like to get her back. The father-in-law wants to get her back. So the Foreign Office inquires of Eichmann, does he know where this woman is? As soon as Eichmann gets that inquiry, he has her deported. And during the trial, Hausner said, they just asked where she was and you immediately had her deported. In other words, should any Jew look like he or she was going to escape death, Eichmann went after them, got them, deported them.
What about the attitudes of those early on who had questioned or even criticized the Israelis for holding this trial?
Some of them change. Many of the people who criticized the Israelis for holding this trial, who asked, can this man get a fair trial in a court with Jewish judges? Of course, as Hannah Arendt points out, no one asked that question when there were trials in Poland or there were trials in Czechoslovakia after the war. No one said the Poles suffered so terribly from the Germans, how can they conduct a fair trial? But when it came to the Jews, the question was asked. People were tremendously impressed. Even Arendt, who was very critical of Hausner and critical of Ben-Gurion, whom she saw pulling the strings behind the trial. People were impressed with the fairness of the judges and the way in which the trial was conducted. Was the trial entirely fair? It was in a Jewish court. It was in a courtroom that was populated by Jews. Jews played all the main parts except that of the defendant and the defending attorney. The defending attorney was operating at a liability, or he knew that if he put the survivors who were in the witness box through a grueling cross-examination, it wouldn't win him any points with the judges. So in that sense, I don't think it was the fairest trial that could have been held. Was the man guilty? Absolutely. Was it clear that he was guilty? Absolutely. Was he more than just a follower of orders? Was he inventive? Was he creative? Absolutely. With a small staff, Raoul Hilberg, the historian of the great historian of the Final Solution, points out that how Eichmann, with a small staff, managed to arrange deportations, managed to gather up Jews, managed to empty towns and cities of Jews in a way that didn't arouse opposition, didn't arouse protests from the surrounding population. He did it, and he did his job very well.
Thanks so much, Deborah.
You're welcome.
That's Deborah Lipstadt, whose new book, The Eichmann Trial, is reviewed in this week's book review. This is a very exciting week for us. Our new children's books editor, Pamela Paul, has put together in every facet the children's books reviews for this week. She also has a back page essay. It's really a profile of an interview with the quite amazing Beverly Cleary, age 95. Pamela's here to talk about it. Hi, Pamela.
Hi, Sam.
Before we get to Beverly Cleary, just tell us briefly what you've done here in the children's section.
Well, probably the biggest change is the bookshelf is now thematic, which is to say that all the books in this issue are on the theme of green, books about nature, the environment, ecology. The reason I made the bookshelf thematic was because as a person who reads children's books, buys children's books, I know that often you think about what your child is, what subjects they're interested in. And that's the way teachers and librarians often think about books. If your child is interested in pirates, then you want to know what's out there with pirates. Or if you want to give your child books about friendship, how to form new friends, you want to know what great books there are about friendship. And so this will now be a regular feature where the bookshelf each month is going to be thematic. And sometimes it'll be tied to the time of year. April is obviously Earth Day, so it made sense and kids are spending more time outdoors. Or it might be something that's, you know, a perennial favorite subject, whether it's pirates or vampires or dogs.
And just to clarify, Pamela, the bookshelf is the feature you write yourself, where you select some books and write capsule reviews of them.
Yes, exactly.
And who are some of the reviewers you're featuring this week? I see some pretty interesting bylines here, as we say.
Yes. We have David Margalek, who, of course, wrote an amazing book about Joe Louis, reviewing two books that have come out about the boxing legend Joe Louis. And we have Dana Stevens, who is the film critic at Slate. And very appropriately, she reviewed a book that was all the talk of the Bologna Book Children's Book Festival last year, The Emerald Atlas, that everyone is basically saying reads like a screenplay, and you can just imagine it being the next sort of middle grade Harry Potter fantasy movie series. So it was great to have her look at that. And then there is a really amazing new YA novel that I think has tremendous crossover appeal by Ruta Sepetys about the really massacre of Lithuanians under Stalin in World War II.
This is Between Shades of Grey?
Yes,
is the novel?
Yes. And the reviewer for that book, Linda Sue Park, has written everything from picture books to YA, and recently did a book around African genocide for YA readers. And so she was a great person to look at that book.
Well, speaking of great people, Beverly Cleary, an American institution, I think one can very plausibly make the case, one of the great living American authors. And she gave a very rare interview to you. Tell us what it was like to speak with her.
Well, Beverly Cleary, who turns 95 on April 12th, I think when I tell people that I have interviewed her, everyone is just startled and delighted and amazed to know that she is alive and very much kicking. She is funny, which I think is really the distinctive character of her books and part of their reason for the enduring appeal.
And Pamela Beverly Cleary, the author of some of the great modern children's classics.
Ramona the Pest, Henry Huggins, The Mouse and the Motorcycle. These are books that, you know, librarians say they still can't keep off the shelf. And I think the reason is because they are funny. They are irreverent. And Beverly Cleary really is exactly the same way, very lively. When you read back on these books, even though this idyllic, safe neighborhood of Clittitat Street has changed in that, you know, kids aren't rushing out on the streets after supper every night to play kickball with their friends. You know, of course, they're inside playing the oboe after doing their advanced geometry homework. The world itself of these children really hasn't changed. And you go back, you read something like Ramona the Pest, and it's incredibly modern. And what's so amazing and wonderful about Beverly Cleary is she was not didactic at all. She, you know, Ramona is a very real little girl. She's funny. She is imperfect. She can be bratty and she can be a pest. But she's completely recognizable as a kindergarten age child. Everyone can relate to her. The books are really were written for second, third, fourth grade children who generally we think of wanting to read about kids that are older than themselves because they're always aspiring up. But everyone, Beverly Cleary said, fell in love with Ramona through the Henry Huggins and the Beegis books and wanted more Ramona, even though she was just in kindergarten.
Pamela, one of the real delights in your essay is that you interviewed another wonderful children's book author who's enormously influenced by Beverly Cleary.
Judy Blume. Yes, it was my Main Street School girlhood dream come true to talk to Judy Blume and Beverly Cleary in 1 week. I can still remember at my library exactly where their books were shelved, where every week I would go and look desperately to see if something new had come out. And Judy Blume really considers Beverly Cleary to be one of her main inspirations as an author. They're both the big authors of realistic fiction for both boys and girls from the 60s, 70s, and 80s.
What does Beverly Cleary herself like to read, assuming she's still reading at the age of 95?
She is still reading. Her eyesight is failing, unfortunately. But she doesn't read children's literature. She told me that she likes to read English novels about genteel women clipping their forsythia.
Well, I can imagine Ramona clipping the neighbor's forsythia, but she wouldn't be very genteel when she did.
Definitely not.
Thanks a lot, Pamela.
Thank you.
That's Pamela Paul, the New York Times Book Review's children's books editor, and also this week the author of a back page essay, a profile of Beverly Cleary. Jennifer Schuessler is here with Bestseller News. Hi, Jenny.
Hi, Sam.
What's on the list this week?
Well, we've got new books on top of both lists. Over on the fiction side, Jean All is back with her latest tale of adventure in the romance during the Ice Age. It's called Land of the Painted Caves, and it is the sixth volume of the series she kicked off more than 30 years ago with Clan of the Cave Bear.
I must be getting old because that still seems like yesterday to me.
Seems that way to me, too. And I know when the book first appeared, she was really praised for the meticulous research she had done into life in the Stone Age. But for me, reading in junior high, what really stuck in my mind was all the hot Neanderthal sex.
Whoa, now I wish I'd read it. Any other new titles?
Well, speaking of hot sex, not with Neanderthals, there's another kind of interesting flashback of a book on the list this week. It's called Sweet Valley Confidential. It's at number 14. And yes, it is an adult sequel of sorts to the mega-selling Sweet Valley High series that, you know, has sold tens of millions of books worldwide. And here, the author, Francine Pascal, tracks her heroines, the adorable, blonde, perfect identical twins, Elizabeth and Jessica Wakefield, into the adult life in New York City. And let me tell you, things have changed. On page 7, one of the characters is having an orgasm. Before too long, their mother is swearing like a sailor. The two girls are having a feud. And just all sorts of crazy stuff is happening. We're really not in high school anymore.
We have a copy of this around?
I took it home.
Well, Jenny, not to cast aspersions, but let's move a little higher up the intellectual food chain, and one of the great modern American novelists has a posthumous bestseller, his first?
Yes, David Foster Wallace has his first hardcover bestseller. His new novel, The Pale King, it's about the IRS, believe it or not, does hit the list this week at number 16.
What about nonfiction?
Howard Schultz is on top of the nonfiction list with his book, Onward. Howard Schultz, as I'm sure you know or will remember after you have another cup of coffee, is the CEO of Starbucks. And a couple of years ago, he led a like pretty gutsy sort of rebranding campaign. On February 8th, 2008, he closed about 7,000 Starbucks outlets in the United States for a very public mass barista re-education campaign to teach everybody to get back in touch with how to make the perfect espresso. Sam, I think we should consider the same move.
It's true. The perfect book review. Can we do it?
Not in 3 hours.
Thanks a lot, Jenny.
Thanks, Sam.
Thanks for listening. And remember, there's more at nytimes.com/books. You can tell us what you think of this show or any New York Times podcast by emailing podcasts@nytimes.com. I'm Sam Tannenhaus.